Welcome to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
And that was Selma Ertel, our skilled producer, and we're about to hear from Dr. Oren Leder. Dr. Leder is an amphibious creature. He was born in Australia and emigrated to Israel some years ago. His particular interest is in endoscopy, and indeed in interventional endoscopy, and he is the leader of the endoscopy unit at Shadrach Zvi Hospital in Jerusalem. He has recently become the lead author on a description of something new to me, which is the idea of interventional endoscopy in Crohn's disease to address the problems that are caused by inflammation, constriction, stricture, and other features that mark that disorder. He says it can be done. Well, how many people out there are doing it? That's one of the questions I'm interested in hearing about from Dr. Leder. The best person to talk about it is clearly not me, but him.
So first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a wonderful opportunity to be speaking and meeting wonderful people here. I think it's a skill set which is becoming more and more widespread. I think the actual skill set of endoscopic dilatation is something that's been used for many years, and particularly in esophageal strictures. And it's just applying the same technique in a slightly more challenging scenario, but essentially the same technique.
The only option beforehand was patients or surgery.
Correct. With patients with significant symptoms, complications, obstructive symptoms, malnutrition, then they needed surgery. At times it was pushed off as long as possible. We try to avoid surgery as much as possible in Crohn's. But in those patients where it was unavoidable, then correct, they went to surgery.
Now, I've been wondering to myself, why does one put off surgery as long as possible in Crohn's? Why not strike while the iron is hot, while there's a problem, get it sorted out and move on to the next step?
It's a very good question, and it's actually been challenged recently, initially when going back decades, where there was very limited treatment options for Crohn's. Surgery was essentially the only sort of relatively long-term management intervention that had some period of time where the patient was asymptomatic. The only problem is when people have a return of the inflammation and return of surgery, then they ended up with severe consequences of short gut. Mm-hmm. So historically, the approach was to avoid surgery as much as possible. Now we're in a slightly different generation of treatments. We have wonderfully effective medications. Obviously, nothing's perfect. We still have many patients that aren't under control. And there's even, based on data from a few years ago, the famous LYRIC study, looking at as surgery is an initial intervention and following up patients compared to those who started down the regular track of drugs. And it was followed up to 1 year and then up to 3 years. Essentially, it is an option. Surgery is an option for some patients, and we should be less scared of surgery when necessary. And obviously, it's a joint decision making between the doctors and the patients. But still, if things can be managed without surgery, then that's preferable.
Understood. Now, the longer it seems, maybe I'm misinferring, yet it seems to me that the longer an inflammatory process is allowed to smolder, not quite to burn bright, but just to worsen and worsen little by little, day by day, that the longer you put off any kind of surgery, the greater the chance is that the process will be irremediable by endoscopic dilatation. The strictures get longer, don't they?
They can get longer, they can get tighter. It's dependent on the amount of time that the inflammatory process is ongoing. As I said, with the newer generations of medications, we're more successful in slowing down the process. Mm-hmm. At times, we're not completely successful. We manage to slow down the process but not stop the process. And at times, the damage is done already before the diagnosis was made and before treatment could have been undertaken.
Are you telling me that the medication intervention just shifts the time curve for manifestations of Crohn's disease?
Correct. It seems to be that way. There's conflicting data again as to how well we've managed to reduce the surgery rate with the newer drugs. But on the whole, it seems to be that there is a trend to reduce surgical intervention. Not as much as we would have hoped, but it does seem to be the case. And in day-to-day with patients who we 15, 20 years ago might have referred off to surgery and now we're able to hold things out a bit longer.
Hold things out a bit longer. That's what I wanted to get into with the drill down. What would you rather have? A gripey belly and no surgery or a chance that, at last I can eat what I want again in surgery?
Yeah.
Are those the I'm sure you don't present the options to your patients and their families just like that. But, how do you choose the patients in whom you think this one's a good one for endoscopic dilatation work? And her, I don't think so.
You raise a very good point. It's not black and white. There's not patients who, there are some patients that obviously there is no alternative besides surgery. And there are some patients who would not need surgery at all to be considered. But there's a lot of patients in that gray zone where the surgery can be considered and should be considered at some point along the line of, especially if we're trying different medications, at some point surgery should be considered. Mm-hmm. Those who I would consider for endoscopic dilatation would be those who have a stricture that's, according to data, possible to dilate, which means, first of all, it's something that should be able to be reached fairly easily. And it should be also sufficiently short, meaning long strictures more than 4 to 5 centimeters in length are less responsive to dilatation. All strictures can essentially be reached if you're using, balloon enteroscopy. You can get into strictures in the small bowel, but that's a limited skill set which most centres don't have. So essentially most strictures that we would consider would be those in the colon, in the terminal ileum, in the upper GI tract where it occurs. And not for anybody who's got a stricture that we see on imaging. It's something that would need to be managed for a clinical benefit. The patient who we find that they have a stricture but feels great and has no restricted diet, I wouldn't recommend dilating the stricture. But a patient who comes with the inability to eat a full meal or is restricted to a low-fiber diet, recurrent nausea, vomiting postprandially, that's the patient
who... You have to do something for that kid.
Correct.
Absolutely. Right. How did it happen that... I feel a little bit nervous about saying this, but is it really true that an Eastern European Ashkenaz population is indeed at higher risk for Crohn's disease?
It seems to be the case.
And so effectively, in uprooting yourself and moving to Israel, you went where the money was. I guess I'm asking, was your interest in this particular approach in Crohn's disease in particular, did it develop in Australia or did it develop after you got to Israel?
It developed in Australia. And Israel is a bit of a perfect storm in terms of the genetic predisposition, as you said. Mm-hmm. And also the rapidly developing economy there, it's moved very quickly into the developed world. So all the risk factors, the environmental risk factors, as well as the genetic factors, seem to be in oversupply in Israel. So yes, we do see a large number, but there are a large number of other centers around the world that see not too dissimilar numbers of Crohn's disease. my interest was piqued in my first year as a fellow. I was in Sydney with
Give us an anecdote. Tell us about the patient.
It was more the doctor than the patient. I worked under Avi Lemberg, who a wonderful guy, and good friends with him as well. But he was my mentor for the first year fellowship, and he's got a particular interest in IBD. Mm-hmm. So as my very green new gastro fellow,
it's Conrad Lorenz, and you're ready. You're right out of the shell, and you're ready to say, "You must be my dad." Okay. And you wind up following a bearded Swiss ethnozoologist all over the place.
It did start like that. I mean, he piqued my interest in IBD, and it's just basically developed since then. And now, since moving to Israel, I'm in the center with an all-star cast of IBD-ologists. We've got a wonderful IBD center.
That leads quickly into the next question that I want to ask is, I sit across the table from you, and looking at you, in spite of the white around the temples,
and
in spite of the gray in the hair, I say to myself, he is so crazy young. How did he reach a position of eminence that makes him the first author on this paper? You have to tell me a little bit about your previous publications and about how you've taken the field forward in your own independent work.
Most of my research has been in the field of IBD. As I said, the center that I'm in is a very productive research center with tremendous support that really makes it easy. And you obviously need the initiative and the stamina to put out quality research, but the system around and the people around really pushes people forward who want to excel in research. So I really had an easy time of it. There's because of my interest and in IBD, then I've been looking for projects, and not necessarily looking for projects just to get a paper out, just things that interest me, just challenges that we meet in clinical practice.
Tell the story. Tell it again. Back to the anecdote.
Back to the anecdote. I haven't got one particular anecdote.
A particular something that piqued your interest and said, "I need to follow this out."
Specifically with the field of endoscopic dilatation, there was the odd case here and there of which I enjoyed doing, kind of just a bit of an endoscopy fan, and I look for the challenging cases to do.
This is the Pokemon approach, got to get them all.
I was, checking the lists and speaking to my colleagues and running into the procedure room for when there was cases that it's turned to the case now where they actually call me when this case is coming. And I had one particular patient who had a stricture on his IC valve, mm-hmm. and quite symptomatic, and the MRI was quite a very clear, short stricture. And tried dilating him, and he had a short-term clinical effect, and it was still quite inflamed over there, so we tried changing the medication. Some improvement, short-lasted, tried to manage his medication, dilated him again. By the time we got to the third dilatation, I said, "That's it. I think we've really run this to the end, and we need to look at surgery. You know, we've already moved on to..." I think we were on a second line or a third line of drug by that time. Mm-hmm. And... he enjoyed the dilatations. He said, "I feel good. It's a simple procedure. I'm scared of surgery." And despite my recommendations against that, he kept on saying, "I want to keep on trying this." And we tried another line of medication. And we got to the point where on this patient, I did 8 dilatations. And against my clinical judgment, and not that I thought it was problematic, I just thought that it was futile. In the end, he was right. After the 8th dilatation on a new medication, he's now been symptom-free on the same medication for 6 years.
Well, that's cause for congratulations in any event. However it happened, fantastic. Tell us a little bit about some of the changes in the disease process itself that can be expected after a dilatation. You're altering the pattern of flow of chyme and possibly feces within the GI tract. You're changing the period of exposure of the mucosa to certain substances. How are you starting to take a look at that and seeing if the changes that are associated with relieving the stricture can be duplicated through maybe even pharmacologic manipulation?
It's a very complicated question. The supposed mechanisms of Crohn's disease is obviously a genetic predisposition, and there's environmental factors, and involved in that is sort of microenvironmental factors, including dysbiosis. So when you get an altered microbial pattern, which could be more pro-inflammatory, one of the things that could occur. Proximal to a stricture is that you have, due to the reduced flow of luminal contents, you can get a regional dysbiosis. The way I describe this to some of my patients in very simple terms is, in Israel, there's quite a mountainous country, and you get these natural springs that sort of fill up. You get these it's sort of water coming out of a mountain that fills up a little pool, and it's very popular for young people to go swimming, jumping in them in the summer months. But because it doesn't rain much in the summer in Israel, the water's beautiful and fresh by the spring. As it's getting replenished by new flows of water. But by the end of the summer, it's quite green or brown, and usually only the bravest kids jump in them. So it's all dependent on the flow rate. So when you've got a flow of fresh, clean water, then the water's nice and fresh. As soon as the things get stagnated, then it becomes quite murky. So the same approach seemingly occurs in the bowel above strictures. We do have some patients, and it's at the level of theory at the moment, where they might have some difficult to manage pre-stenotic inflammation, meaning the drug of choice is working beautifully to settle the inflammation everywhere, and we see a short area, or sometimes not such a short area, just above the stricture, which doesn't seem to respond. Theoretically. If we can relieve the stricture, we can improve the flow, reduce the level of dysbiosis, and potentially increase or improve the level of inflammation proximal to the stricture. This is, again, at the level of theory, but we have a few patients here and there that we have seen.
Oh, you're taking it beyond theory. You're sampling the contents north of the stricture, and you're comparing them with this content south.
It's a good point. We have started a project that we received an ESPGAN networking grant, where there's a number of centers involved currently and looking to expand it. We're essentially looking at patients who we would refer out normally for a dilatation for a stricture with pre-stenotic inflammation. And the study is an observational study, meaning we're not referring patients for the study, but patients who we would otherwise refer we're following up. And we're assessing for the effect of the dilatation as a standalone intervention to impact the pre-stenotic inflammation as measured by cross-sectional imaging, mainly with ultrasound, and also endoscopically where needed for clinically to assess both immediately after the dilatation and down the track. We're taking this further as well, looking for a further grant to essentially check the microbiome,
yes,
proximally and
yes,
distally, with both luminal aspirates and mucosal biopsies, looking at both qualitative and quantitative analysis of the microbiome.
You're going to take us so far with this. This is going to be wonderful.
it's a complicated study. I think also because of the recruitment, it's a very limited pool of patients. But I think if we can generate good data, this will actually give us a bit more of a mechanistic insight into the inflammatory process. If we see that there's a difference between the microbiome above and below the stricture.
Well, that's my hope for you. We don't have time, I don't think, to get into the not a good candidate criteria, the 4% that are at risk of complications, things such as abscesses or fistulae or what have you. But instead, it's time to say goodbye. But we always say goodbye in these podcasts after asking the person being interviewed to contribute for all of us to enjoy, something that is special to her or to his homeland. And as I mentioned, you're an amphibian. So water or air, what's it going to be? Australia or Israel?
Tough call. I chose a song from Israel, something that it's hard to find a favorite song because I have a lot of favorite songs, which is one my daughters have been playing recently and I've been hearing in the background, and then I've adopted it as my new favorite. It's called Yerushalayim, which is Hebrew for Jerusalem, which is like a very simple song, but it's like a mix of sort of an old-time song with an 80s rock sound, and I just started to like it.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you so much for making yourself available for this podcast interview, and safe travels home.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you.